Okay, you're listening to www.killradio.org. My name's James Maverick. Welcome to Higher Ground, Coast to Coast. Got a little bit of Doors playing in the background here. And I think what we should do is we should have like a big-ass Jim Morrison shrine here at Kill Radio, because Jim Morrison is so Kill Radio spirit, it's not even funny. So I went out because I've got a show here on in the mornings as well, which I play gospel, hip-hop, and R&B music. And usually I just hang out at here at the studio for, you know, for like 6 hours until this show starts, because I have no life. But I decided actually to go out and have a life. I went to see the Bourne Ultimatum over at the Arclight Theater, which I have termed as the Suckaplex, because I handed over $14 for a movie ticket. And that movie ticket involved me getting a seat near the front of the theater, like butt up against the screen and off to the side. So it was weird. It was like one of those strange picture books, you know, where you're looking at a certain angle and everything looks all so Matt Damon has his tiny little head. Julia Stiles has his big old head. And that was because Julia Stiles was like on the right side of the screen and Matt Damon was at the left side of the screen. So I was really frustrated. But it was like the closest theater that I could go to actually check out the movie and still get back here on time. So I the movie, you know, was still a head rush. I kind of liked it. David Strathern can do no wrong. You know, I saw him in Good Night and Good Luck, and that was pretty good. So, I mean, I think he should have won, but then I didn't see Capote, so he should have won an Academy Award, I think, for his role in Good Night and Good Luck, because he does like this zip bang Edward R. Murrow. I mean, it's just he does so much with his face that, you know, other actors today just spend so much time just with exposition, you know. He can just roll his eyes in a way that it would take someone like, ooh, let's see, who shall we say? Paris Hilton, you know, like an hour and a half of dialogue, you know. So anyway, we have a wonderful guest here, and I met this fine woman about a month ago when I was doing a... Oh, hey, thanks, man. Yeah, ooh, cool. When I was doing a Poets in the Classroom thing for Upward Bound, a friend of ours, Don Campbell, over at Occidental College, I ended up taking the day off of work, and it was something I couldn't afford, but you know what? It was so worth it just to talk to the kids and talk poetry and share some of our poetry with them, and they were really excited and really receptive, and it was just a really great, day just to spend with Don and Ruth Nolan, who's my guest today. Ruth Nolan is a former Wildland firefighter. Woo! And she is assistant professor of English at the College of the Desert in Palm Springs, where she teaches poetry, creative writing, desert, and Native American literature. She is also founder and advisor of the COD literary and visual arts magazine Solstice. She has recently published poetry in Inlandia, a literary journey through California's inland empire and desert regions, and it was published last year by Heyday Books, and her poetry has also recently appeared in Poemelian. Did I get that right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. And, well, let's see, Pacific Review, Mosaic, Genie, and Women's Studies Quarterly. She also teaches seminars in Native American literature, as well as poetry writing workshops for the University of California, Riverside Extension, California State University Extension, and Living Desert University. I am so glad that you're here.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. I'm looking at like a whole bunch of stuff that you brought here with you. Some from the College of the Desert. This is Solstice. Is this a quarterly or annual?
This is our college literary and visual arts magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And we're putting it out once a year, featuring student and faculty writing and art.
Okay.
And photography and digital design.
Sweet. And it's designed very, very beautifully. And I've got a... this looks kind of, let's see, it looks like a human. It looks like I've got a little belly button here. Is this a torso that's happening on this cover?
I think that might work.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I've got an issue of Mosaic, which is a literary journal. And this is also beautifully rendered.
Yeah, it's out of UC Riverside.
Okay, that's gorgeous. And I also have your work Inlandia here. Well, it's not your work, but it's got some of your work in here as well. The must-have book of the season?
Yeah, featuring literature by and about people in the so-called dismal, meth-addled Inland Empire region of Southern California in the deserts. And nobody has really been too keen on what's going on out there except negative stuff.
Well, I think it's been that way ever since they moved the Roy Rogers Museum, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I grew up in Apple Valley, actually. You can see Roy and Dale out in the country club out there in Apple Valley when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And they were actually very nice people.
Oh, gosh. They're the sweetest people on the face of this earth.
They are. My daughter almost ran Dale Evans over with a grocery cart. We were in the market.
Oh,
my
goodness.
She was like 3 years old. My daughter.
Oh, okay. She was 3 years old.
Yeah.
So she wasn't licensed to drive a grocery cart.
Right.
Okay.
Dale was very gracious about it.
Oh, good.
But, yes, that was a major downfall for our local joy and spirit to lose Trigger, you know, to Missouri. That was kind of a low blow.
Yeah.
From California,
There was some vandalism that happened upon Trigger.
I know about that with the blue testicles.
Yeah, they painted his testicles blue.
Right, and that was probably done by local high school pranksters. But
yeah.
I thought it was pretty funny.
Well, I did too. I mean, but still, you know, he's a stallion. You know, he's a stud.
But it was the statue, not the real.
Oh, he was a statue.
Yeah, it was the
figurehead. Okay.
Because I saw it.
Oh, okay. So they just painted his brass balls blue.
I don't know if it was brass.
Oh,
it was
like
a 20-foot high statue in front of the museum.
Whoa.
And so, you know, it was just there for the vandalizing. But it was creative vandalism.
I guess there's some.
He didn't mind. He's frustrated. He's been up there, you know, in the Winnie position.
Yeah.
Yeah, for, you know.
He was ready for Mountain.
He was.
Yeah, so.
And there were a lot of dead animals in the museum that Roy Rogers had actually gone off to Africa before it was politically incorrect to go slaughter animals in Africa. And so you go into that museum, or I did go as a kid growing up, and there's like cougars and lions and tigers and panthers. It was, so I think Trigger, that was a little form of protest.
Mm-hmm.
He would have condoned the creative vandalism.
But that was a long time ago. It was an entirely different sensibility back then. It was like the 60s.
Right, when revisiting history, you can't. But, you know, to someone, you know, with the level 4 vegans running around, that was, you know.
They have vegans in the Inland Empire?
They do.
Oh, my gosh. I thought
they
were
desert.
Only.
Well,
I thought they were
two.
Here only in Los Angeles.
When I was
Angeles.
Growing up, there were only two in Apple Valley.
There were only two in the world.
Right.
Yeah. So.
You know, but I was a little reaching out for other things besides Inland Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew that there was more out there than, you know, the animal rights thing was catching on a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone growing up, that was a little shocking to see all the animals. But there was some very nice fur, so I could appreciate that from the aesthetic point of view.
Oh, okay. Cool. So let's talk about things like, well, when we were together at Occidental College, we talked about inspiration a little bit. And I had read something to the kids by Roald Dahl to show them how they could get inspiration for practically anything. In this case, it was a children's story.
Right.
So let's talk about inspiration. What inspired you to write?
What inspired me to write was oppression. And I say that not from a sense of being aware of global or historical oppression as a kid, but oppression I felt in my own life.
Mm-hmm.
Being Catholic and female, the only girl in a family of boys. And
oh, no oppression there.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
And I had three brothers, and they were very loud and rowdy and artistic, and they played guitar. Mm-hmm. So rather than join in the fracas, I decided to go into my room and start writing mm-hmm. when I was about 9 or 10. It wasn't a conscious decision. But I think I was inspired by wanting to do something artistic. I just wanted to tell stories. So mm-hmm. I'm not really sure where the original inspiration came from, except that I felt a need to sort of break out of just feeling mm-hmm. like, where's my creativity in this crazy mm-hmm. big family, big Catholic Irish family?
Oh, okay.
So, and later, I would say the inspiration really started coming in my high school English class. Mm-hmm. I had one of those really cool from the 60s kind of teachers who smoked pot, you know.
Oh, okay, cool.
You know.
Kind of like Donald Sutherland in Animal House.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Not quite as crazy.
Oh, okay.
But, so, you know, I got inspired to really enjoy literature, and that mm-hmm. made me want to write more. Mm-hmm. And then I felt very inspired also by my firefighting experiences. Mm. That was the first time. I didn't grow up in an outdoors family. Mm-hmm. But my dad moved us to the high desert when I was about 13, and it was really remote then in mm-hmm. Apple Valley. And I went out, I signed up when I was 18 looking for adventure. I went to sign up to be on a firefighting crew. Mm-hmm. And getting out into the middle of nowhere and fighting these big flames mm-hmm. and then ending up spending the night on the tops of rock hills and waking up at sunrise. It was really spiritual, mm. very hallucinogenic mm-hmm. without the drugs. I mean, the drugs came later.
Oh, okay.
You know, when you got home from the fire, you did the drugs.
Now, we'll talk fun peyote drugs. And Pepsi later.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So. But anyway, I think one of
Dana
my...
Dana was right behind you when I said peyote and Pepsi, and he goes, yeah. Whoa. So, no, it was Ryan. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had this, like, nonplussed look on his face, and I was like, whoa. You down with peyote and Pepsi there, Ryan?
Yeah, it's a little bitter, but yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool.
But I really got inspired by the desert, you know, mm-hmm. that it was such a really wild place to grow up and be a kid and just be out hiking around with my dog. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what compelled me to do that, because most of the kids wanted to go down the hill to shop in the malls. But I wanted to go out in the desert and the firefighting and the desert scenery. And I think later when I started teaching high school, mm-hmm. I got very motivated to write. And mm-hmm. that was where we came in, you and I both mm-hmm. Enjoying the experience working with The Upward Bound.
Oh,
that
beautiful.
That was really uplifting to me, because I taught high school for 4 years mm-hmm. in Victorville and in South Phoenix, and had really missed being with that age group since I was teaching college.
Yeah.
So, and I wrote a lot of poems that were inspired by my students.
Oh, cool. And great. So, yeah, I'd like to get to that in just a second. And okay. one of the things that I loved about doing series over at Upward Bound is that it's something a friend of mine who actually teaches at Occidental says that one of the highs that he gets from educating is the discovery. You know, mm-hmm. it's like when you see that little light click right. on, you know. So
yeah, I worked with a lot of mm-hmm. students with very serious problems. A lot mm-hmm. of kids coming up from inner cities, getting what they call relocated mm-hmm. to the high desert regions back in the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And I felt there was so much rich subject material there, mm. you know, to some raw matter. A lot of kids had really experienced a lot of life mm-hmm. in a short time. And that the writing, especially poetry, really gave people an outlet. And that further inspired me not only to write things to and about my students, but to just write more and realize mm-hmm. how important writing can be, just to making that one little link, that light coming on. Mm-hmm. Where you suddenly feel like you're a person, you belong, you have something to say, you have a voice. Mm-hmm. So that's a very driving force for me as well.
Oh, good.
In writing and teaching. That sense cool. that writing can give you that voice and sense of self you may not otherwise have.
Mm-hmm. Do you see a sense of freedom in your art? Because you do talk about, you said that you started talking about oppression. Mm-hmm. And I think if there's a spiritual opposite to freedom, it would be that.
Yeah, I think the freedom would be the idea that you can change whatever reality you're experiencing through mm-hmm. writing. So mm. if you say, well, life sucks or whatever, I'm just sitting here in my room. If you can make a poem out of something you've experienced that you say you feel not in control of mm-hmm. in your life, and that poem can then give you a sense, the act of writing it liberates mm-hmm. you in the sense that you feel empowered.
Oh, cool.
And I do that a lot when I'm teaching, is how writing can empower people mm-hmm. to create their own worlds. And, of course, poetry also can change, can start revolutions or inspire even the so-called American Revolution, right? We had Thomas
yes.
Paine, mm-hmm. writing his amazing poetry and journals.
Yeah, it was...
To inspire the troops.
Oh, gosh, what did he say?
The Summer Soldier Thomas and Sunshine Patriot. The
Yeah. Ah, thank you. Yes.
These are the times that try men's souls. Mm-hmm. In today's era, with Iraq and many other things that a lot of people worldwide are unhappy with mm-hmm. American imperialism, we see a lot of poetry emerging that's speaking against certain issues and dictators. And mm-hmm. So poetry, even as we sit here speaking in an historical sense, is making a really big impact mm-hmm. on politics and awareness. And mm-hmm. so I like that's one of the, you know, you're one little person sitting in your room, and yet you can feel like you're part of this tradition mm-hmm. of great poetry and great poets changing the world.
You're absolutely right, because there is a storytelling and there is mm-hmm. a history telling. There is a recordation of history when you do talk about or when you do have poetry. Mm-hmm. There is that sense in a lot of Langston Hughes' work, particularly in The Panther and the Lash, which you will find a lot of his works regarding racism and regarding the war were not only timely at the time that it was published, which I think was like the mid-60s, but also just as vital and just as relevant today.
Absolutely, and that's coincidental that you bring up Langston Hughes. He's an amazing poet who I use a lot in my classes. Mm-hmm. And also, yesterday I was had helped coordinate a poetry reading mm-hmm. featuring several poets, including Jeff over here, who's in part of the show today.
We're going to hear from Jeff later on,
yeah.
right?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we're going to twist his arm. Okay.
And so I had picked D. Langston Hughes' poem, Let America Be America.
Oh, yeah.
To
it's
read
one of my favorites.
At this human rights activity that took place in Riverside yesterday. And so I felt the same thing, what you're talking about, the universal appeal mm-hmm. of enduring poetry that when he was talking about such issues, oppression and mm-hmm. slavery and racism and injustice, mm-hmm. That these are themes that not only resonated in his era, but continue to resonate for people today. And so that was very exciting to think we're part of a tradition.
Yeah.
So I would hope that my work in some part might reach out to people in that sense and help talk about mm-hmm. and touch and address something that's just bigger than my own personal experience.
Well, do you have anything that you think strikes that universal chord that you'd like to share with us right now?
Well, sure. This okay. poem I just wrote a few days mm-hmm. ago, it's called Lunch with a Homeless Man.
Okay.
I might have invited you for Greek salad and wine, but you might not have liked the thick crumbling of feta cheese. My own mix of tahini, recipes I've memorized by heart. You might have come to clean my kitchen, laugh at the disarray of glasses and teacups, the lack of forks in the drawer. You did once bring spoons from the Goodwill. Dinner would be no easier. I usually heat a cup of soup for one, use the plastic spoon, very inefficient environmentally, don't tell anyone. Plums out of season from a bag I bought of 6 for $3.99 at Trader Joe's. I don't shop efficiently. You have cleaned the refrigerator and know the secrets there. The caked old box of baking soda, the egg grunge glued to the side shelf, my daughter's long ago experiment in perfecting a souffle for her boyfriend, the cans of Diet Coke mingling with green tea power bars, mm-hmm. cans of Hansen's Diet Red, flaxseed and outdated salad mix. It's the freezer of my heart, those old heads of lettuce. The ice huddled in conglomerate chunks, unable to pass through the dispenser. When you put your glass to its lips, the water doesn't come through. I've lived alone for years. You offer to cook, but I lack fresh basil, and the jars of herbs are from the dollar store and dated expires in 1999. It was easier to share lunch today with a homeless man, parked outside of Del Taco, where I opted for a bean and cheese burrito and gave him the other part, French fries, half a quesadilla, and a chicken taco purchased separately, thrown in for goodwill. He didn't need a spoon or fork, and I didn't open my drawers. No hot sauce expiration date questioned. No questions of who paid. Now I'm some kind of sidewalk heroine rather than a victim of home cooking. Your heart gone wrong in a twist of corkscrew.
Wow. That's nice. What do you guys think? Like? Yeah? Okay. Okay. No, none of this. No, no, no applause or anything.
Stay
just
quiet. We're on radio.
No. It's okay. Don't. No. Just. Yeah.
I like to think of this poem in terms of being
the love. I love that
a personal experience, mm-hmm. but also addressing the idea of difficulties in relationships, mm-hmm. and I also think I was trying to consider the idea of how we might overlook homeless people, those of us who are fortunate enough to mm-hmm. have a home or have a job or even have, you know, we can afford to be picky about what we eat.
Mm-hmm.
And also I was trying to be a little cheeky about the idea of, you know, thinking that one might be sort of the hero to a homeless person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the act of being benevolent. It's a good thing to do, but it also might be a little self-important. So I was trying to work on different layers in this poem that were personal mm-hmm. and also a little more universal
on
several different levels.
Well, yeah. One of the things that I've noted is that I think poetry always begins with something. And feel free to disagree with me. You know, I mean, you can outnumber me, but I, you know, it's my show. But so, you know, feel free to disagree with me if you want to. But I think that poetry does start with something that is personal. Mm-hmm. And that's where the universality comes in. You know, what do you think?
Yeah, because we all have a lot of common experiences.
Mm-hmm.
We have the differences in the way we express them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's wise to limit what poetry is. As soon as you define it, and I tend to want to break that rule. So as you say it's personal experience, I want to find a poem that has nothing to do with my personal experience, just to challenge your view of what poetry is and break the rule. Mm-hmm. I like rules because that gives me something to break. So I.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sweet. Okay.
So
do you have any rule-breaking poetry there?
I have a lot of rule-breaking poetry.
Let's hit it. Let's see what you got. Hit me.
Well,
smack me upside the head and call me mama.
Well, I have a poem called Men with Breasts.
Okay.
But I didn't bring it because I was doing a little rewriting.
Oh.
And, maybe I'll have to send you a copy of that.
Oh, shoot.
At another time.
You had me at breasts.
Uh-huh. I'm sorry. Well, I have a poem called Menstruating Messiah, and this was inspired by my experiences teaching high school,
mm-hmm.
Which also addresses that same idea of I'm the teacher, these are the students, you know, who mm-hmm. am I to be able to impart wisdom and knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
Where do we get our sense of authority from?
Mm-hmm.
As Dana said, with the forms, why would people think there's only certain things you can write about in poetry or certain things you can say?
Yes.
Not just in poetry, but we're very much aware of these issues, right? Mm-hmm. Censorship that's going on all over the world and threats to freedom of speech. And so I just think it's important to question who is calling the shots. Mm-hmm. And this one was when I was thinking about, well, who am I being the teacher? You know, mm-hmm. what do I know that these some of these kids I'm working with, the teenagers, mm-hmm. they might know that I don't.
Mm-hmm.
Menstruating Messiah. I'm the white high school teacher who wears see-through sparkle nail polish slathered on chewed short finger and cracked toenails, bright red glitter so amazing the young girls at the video store lose their collective breath and promise me a $1 refund if I tell them where I got it. But the dazzle isn't really mine. I confiscated it from a girl from East LA who flipped me off. I took her cigarettes and lighter before I sent her from my room. These fluffy girls don't understand the bruises beneath my thumbs, that I'm 33 and tell Virgin Mary's stories to high-risk teenagers who want to smash people's faces to the ground, that I use a cheap beige foundation to cover a rash of crooked razor lines, my own peculiar taste in tattoos at 14, the burn marks and sea scars section hidden so well now that I'm at the Jesus age.
Ooh.
It's also a little affront to my religious upbringing and a lot of anger I experienced when I wanted to be an altar girl and because I was really into the Jesus thing when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And then being told, well, you can't do that because you're a girl and having no real explanation for that.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that why can't Jesus be a woman? Why can't, you know, God be more than just this guy? So that's another, I think, somewhat rebellious theme in my poetry is not showing that I'm a female who's not going to necessarily follow prescribed patterns of behavior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I really liked about that poem that you had just read was that it just has a very ground level, visceral imagery, mm-hmm. which I absolutely love, especially the part with the girl in East L.A. who flipped you off.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was another part that I really liked, which was a little bit later on. Oh, gosh, it's fading from my head already. Can you go over that again real quick? Because I'd love to see that. I'd love to hear, or is that it right there?
The,
we're flipping through pages.
Yeah,
so
there's a lot of...
You're listening to www.killradio.org. This is Higher Ground Coast to Coast. My guest is Ruth Nolan, and she is an assistant professor at the College of the Desert in Palm Springs. And, yeah. Oh, that's it right there, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, there's a part later in the poem mm-hmm. that you...
Yes.
The girl who flipped the teacher off.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, my goodness. These fluffy girls don't understand the bruises beneath my thumbs. Ooh. That I'm 33 and tell Virgin Mary stories to high-risk teenage girls who want to smash people's faces to the ground. That I use cheap beige foundation to cover a rash of crooked razor lines. My own peculiar taste in tattoos at 14. Oh, man, I absolutely... Oh, I love that.
Well, thank
I love
you.
That. It's very nice.
Mm-hmm. You know, the idea would be that, mm-hmm. you know, how can women really guide other women when they mm-hmm. felt they've been through the same kinds of, mm-hmm. I guess, I hate to use the word oppression again, mm-hmm. but the same issues, you know, and I have a teenage daughter who just turned 19,
mm-hmm.
and there's been a lot of very challenging times in raising her. And I'd like to read as my next poem something
okay.
a reflection of that.
Oh, yes.
Instead of being a parent that just wants to be pretentious and say, mm-hmm. well, don't think about those things. Or, you know, I'm trying to, the poetry allows an honest voice for me anyway to come through and say, well, mm-hmm. wow, you know, those are some really hard questions and there are no mm-hmm. easy answers.
Yeah.
This one's called Maturity Class.
Mm-hmm.
This I wrote when my daughter was about 10 or 11.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have you had sex? Asks my daughter in the bathroom. She guesses 4 or 5, maybe 6. Then she asks, how do you know if a man is going to rape you? I still tuck her in at night with her Barbies. She's afraid of spiders crawling in her bed. The random thumps on the wall made by the man next door and his girlfriend. I know she's been digging through the Kotex pads I bought for her in anticipation, perhaps imagining them to be pillows for her dolls, the tampons a sort of emergency candle equipped with an extra long wick. In the morning, I notice a few grass blades of hair poking out from under her arms, freshly watered. She tells me that she wants to start wearing a bra. Her fingers are clumsy yet with the wear of crayons, and so I must fasten the hook. Wonder what exactly it is that I'm holding back or training to stay in place. And after school, she brings her fifth grade maturity book home, opens it to the chapter about the penis. This is my homework tonight, she giggles. She asks me to read it to her, this new kind of bedtime story. I see that you're laughing. I like, you know, I have some very humorous work.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. There really was a book called Maturity Class.
Oh,
she had a class in fifth grade
mm-hmm.
in her private school called Maturity Class. I said, what am I paying for?
You know, oh, gosh. You know what? You know? My daughter is 9 years old, and uh-huh. I swear to God, if she had brought a picture, I mean, a book with a penis in it and says, this is my homework, my hair would fall out just
yeah.
right then and there.
Well, you better prepare yourself, man. It's all coming. It's all coming.
Oh, gosh.
It's a chapter on the penis, you know?
Oh, gosh. I already kind of experienced that when she was like a year and a half. Because, you know, a year and a half, they're like ambulatory, and they are loving it, you know. So, and because daddies are slow, you know, I never figured out her adventuresome spirit as she's walking around, you know. So, I'm sleeping with her mom at the time, and, you know, we wake up early. It's like Sunday morning. We've got nothing to do. It's very lazy. And, I wear nothing when I sleep, okay? So I'm getting out and going to the bathroom, and then she wakes up, and we meet each other in the hallway, and she reaches for me and says, what's that?
Oh, God.
Excuse me, honey. Daddy's going to go get some shorts. So yeah.
Right.
So, yeah, that was when she started realizing that there was a difference. You know, she didn't know the meaning of homework, so I think I dodged a bullet then.
Well, the bullets are going to be coming fast.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yes.
Literally and figuratively.
Oh, yeah. The bullets started coming since she was 2 weeks old.
2 weeks?
2 weeks old. Oh. I mean, it was her first time. It was her first time out. And we were going to our Lamaze class so that, you know, we could introduce her. Oh. And as soon as we hit the sidewalk, there's the duplex, and then we go down the stairs, and from the stairs to the curb where the car was parked, it's like maybe 10 feet, okay? And the street was empty. I mean, there was nothing going on. So we got about two-thirds of the way to the car where the three little neighborhood kids ranging from 3 to 5, boom, were like on top of us. And they're going, uh-huh. Oh, is this your daughter? Oh, she's so beautiful. I'm going, oh, good Lord. Three guys, right, all already, and she's only 2 weeks old.
Geez.
And the gray hairs are just starting to pop up.
You had a vision.
So, yeah. So,
are you writing any poems about that?
I haven't written a poem about that yet. Oh. I've written several poems while she was growing inside mommy.
Oh. Well, that's a really rich theme for poetry, and mm-hmm. I found myself really that has been a center for a lot of my poetry, is writing about the mother-daughter relationship. I've been a single parent the great majority of my daughter's life, so that's been a very particularly intense relationship for me.
Mm.
And I think that would be something. I've written a lot of poems that maybe help convey a sense of what that experience is like for so many single parents and the difficulties faced in that kind of change in the family unit, you know, from the what we think of, which was never a long-running thing anyway, but that nuclear family idea.
Yeah.
And then, of course, a lot of my work is not just about being a parent, but about being the child of a parent. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to read one.
Oh, yes. You were reading my mind. I was about to ask if you had something like that about, you know, either being a parent or becoming a parent or, you know, that
being a
you know, that transition from singular to, you know, the mother-daughter relationship.
Okay. I can read one about when I was pregnant and I knew I was going to be.
Okay. Whichever you prefer. We got time for both of them, I think. Let's see.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We got plenty of time. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Mm-hmm.
This one is called Prison Visit.
Okay.
My daughter's father went to prison when I was still pregnant with her.
Mm.
And I remember going to visit him in Chino Prison and just being pretty shocked by the whole experience because I'd never been in a prison before.
Mm-hmm.
When you visit prison, it's like going to prison.
Mm.
You ever experienced that?
No.
You go behind lots of iron doors. You have to take everything off. You get searched and so forth. And so here I was, pregnant, 24-year-old, saying, God, you know, this is facing the reality of I'm probably going to end up being a single parent here.
Mm.
So this was a first probably anticipation of really starting to understand what it was going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
Prison visit. I worried about the finger searches the guards made up your ass while I sat quietly on hemorrhoids in the smoky visitor's room, helping you write the list of gifts I was to bring. Chocolate chip cookies, black ballpoint pens, blank letter writing stationery, tiny X-Acto knife tip blades hidden beneath my long fingernails that you could exchange for a carton of cigarettes. The TV was too loud, stuck on some old rerun, and all the guys turned to stare as you jammed my hands between your legs, saying you had a present for me. I left reluctantly through 4 sets of iron doors, wearing borrowed polyester, feeling I'd made the evening news. My hair stank of Marlboros, and I was sad about the years you'd be locked up in blue for shooting your best friend dead. And all the while, your unborn baby kicking and stretching inside me, a red volcano ready to erupt, the hot bullet ricocheting through the chambers of my hollow heart.
Wow.
Now that's, you know, a little bit on the dark side, but I think so often people tend to over sentimentalize parenting and parenthood.
I didn't think that was dark. I thought that was, you know, actually quite vivid.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
and I'll segue into
the next.
What
did you think,
one.
Jeff?
Oh, sorry.
We should bring a microphone over to you there.
Can't hear me?
No.
You're better off.
I mean, I can hear you, but you know, we've got like a number of listeners who might want to hear you there.
I love that poem. I don't know what to say. I kind of know it as a story too, so it's kind of heart-wrenching to me. The idea of the narrator so detached from, you know, the seriousness of the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really captured well in there. And I think that that's one of my favorite ones that Ruth has written.
Oh, yeah.
I have another one. It's a sonnet.
Okay.
And this was written after a difficult night when my daughter was a little kid.
Okay.
And I was going to graduate school and just, you know, I can't function. My daughter got real sick in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, this is another thing for poets who have children, that you get a lot of language from your kids because they're always using expressive, very literal language, and that can very easily be transcribed by the poet parent into some pretty good lines of poetry. So she called strep throat, she called it stretch throat.
Oh.
And so I wrote this poem called Stretch Throat Sonnet. In dreams, as I fondle virile lovers, the child gags on wads of milky vomit. Sleep walks out of bed, peels off the covers, and flings her flat chest and skinny armpits upon swollen breasts. Her acid breath lands on mouths of callous mothers in the gloom, kisses too hungry. Men fade from my hands as her damp lips seek mine, a rancid bloom in these sweet arms reeking of infant bile. She grabs me and cries as I edge away. The pink cat and mouse jammies are vile. I tell her to wash her sticky hair, stay out of my bed, off the down comforter. I want lovers, I do not comfort her.
Hmm.
And that poem was actually just published in Pomelian, which is an online magazine.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay. So, well, I'll tell you what. Let's go over some of the stuff that you have published here. We've got Wild Wash Road by Petroglyph Press.
That's my first chapbook,
mm-hmm.
and I'm one of the co-founders of Petroglyph Press, actually.
Oh, okay.
I had just done that on my own about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jeff and I have started recently Petroglyph Press, which features, or doing chapbooks, mm-hmm. trying to feature poets and writers from the Inland Empire and desert regions.
Oh, okay. Beautiful.
So that was kind of the inspiration, the little chapbook I did there.
Oh, sweet. Okay. Yeah. Did you want to talk any more about Petroglyph Press?
Yeah, well, we're just trying to help the people who may not be... I think so much has changed with the internet and with self-publishing and with advances in publishing that it makes it very possible for anybody who wants to write and to put their work out there, which I think is a really positive thing.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel like you have to go through certain hoops and loops.
Yeah.
And so that's the vision for Petroglyph. Is to promote writing and poets and writers who may not otherwise, you know, be coming through the pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And I envision our press as being not just a written form, but also spoken word, and also with possibilities of being on the internet, doing live readings, posting those to YouTube. So kind of an interactive all around type of experience.
Oh, okay. Cool. All right. So you also have, let me see, you just mentioned Pomelian.
Yes.
That's a website, you said, right?
Yeah, poem, as in poem, and then ELEON.org.
As in chameleon, sort of?
Yes.
Or?
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And that's actually run by a woman out of Riverside. Mm-hmm. She's publishing some very fine poets twice a year at the time in her magazine. So I just had two sonnets. She did an issue on forms. So I had two sonnets that just appeared in there.
Ooh. Great. And let me see. Let's have one more poem, and then we'll take a quick break. And then we'll bring in a couple of more people here.
Great. Well, I'd like to read. This one is called To the Arsonist.
Okay.
And this was also featured. Okay, Jeff
She's
wanted to
getting
hear one.
Encouragement
Jeff
here.
Jeff really
yeah.
likes this poem I just wrote called Racing to the Bottom of the Sea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe I can read that later in
okay.
the show.
Yeah.
Which one do you want to
hear?
We
got time.
Read.
Let's...
To the Arsonist?
Yes.
Okay.
To the Arsonist.
And then we'll do...
Because this is pretty relative to your experience as a firefighter, right?
It is. Mm-hmm. And although not directly inspired by the firefighting, the firefighting experience and the small attention to fires breaking out in the hills and flames, which, as we all know, in Southern California, at least, mm-hmm. very common experience. So whenever I see a fire breaking out, I get kind of alerted and feel like I should be out there working. But I'm glad I'm not. It's very hard work. Very dangerous.
Okay.
This is another sonnet, and this is a recent poem.
Okay.
To the Arsonist. If I could sweep these smoke rings from my thighs, I might surmise a glare, a bite of lip. Your smile would imitate the pink sunrise, tinted eyes, a painter's pinched fingertips. If I could brush aside these clouds instead, perhaps a fire would be stopped, red flare, a short-lived pause of light at mountain's head. We might, between us, ignite without care. But flames invite, they curl me to your side. You pause to glisten, ignorant of homes, coiled snakes that will be casualties. I hide. Behind a smolder, quiet light is stones. The hills will burn tonight. I'll spring with love. You'll torch a cigarette with blue-flamed stove.
Our guest is Ruth Nolan. That was very nice.
Thank you.
I like that. Yeah.
I had fun writing that, too.
Yeah. So, yeah, this is James Maverick. You're listening to Higher Ground, Coast to Coast. And our guest is Ruth Nolan. And we've also got a few other peeps here in the awesome, cavernous Kill Radio studios here. So we're going to have a quick little break here. I'm going to treat you to some smoky. And we will be right back with Jeff and Dana and Ryan and Ruth Nolan right here on Kill Radio. This is Higher Ground, Coast to Coast on killradio.org.
Well, there's a brand new place I found.
Okay, you're listening to www.killradio.org. This is Higher Ground, Coast to Coast. You had a couple by Smokey Robinson there, Going to a Go-Go, and Mickey's Monkey, two of my favorites. So we are here with Ruth Noland, Assistant Professor of Literature. Did I get that right? English Literature?
Well, English and literature. Poetry,
at the College of the Desert in Palm Springs. And she is also one of the co-founders of Petroglyph Press. And we're also here with Jeff Peters, who is her partner. Did I get that right?
Jeff Green is.
Jeff Green. Yeah. Jeff Green. Okay. Brian, I'm sorry. Peters. I got my surnames mixed up. Okay, so we got Jeff Green here, who is also co-founder of Petroglyph Press. We're going to spend a little bit of time with Jeff here. Also, we've got Ryan Peters, okay, and Dana, help me out here.
Stamps,
there we go. Dana Stamps. Also, you also have a chapbook that was also printed by Petroglyph Press. Okay, so we have two also artists who have been published by Petroglyph. They're going to spend a couple of minutes with us and read some of their poetry. And if you feel like joining in, all you got to do is give us a call, 213-252-0998. We would absolutely love to have your poetry read on the air here on Higher Ground, Coast to Coast. I'd like to welcome Mr. Jeff Green. Did I get that surname right this time?
No, it's actually Green Peters.
Sorry. Green Peters. I do not like Green Peters. No, I don't, Sam. I am. No. So, it's Jeff Green. And how long has Petroglyph Press been in existence?
What, about 4 months? Maybe six. I don't know. And we've published two books so far, and we've got about four others in the pipeline. Mm-hmm. And the two books we've done are Screaming Wet Mammals, which is by Ryan Peters, and mm-hmm. Sexy Jesus by Dana Stamps, the second. And
Sexy Jesus.
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, well, if you like that, why don't we have him read the poem? Because I don't know what else to say about it. Mm-hmm. We don't have a website because we're very young.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to contact me about either of these or other information, you can email me at jefe@epicentermagazine.org.
Mm-hmm.
And we have both the books have CDs, and they're about 40 pages. And
the CDs?
The books are 40 pages, and the CDs have about, I don't know, some poems on them.
Mm. Oh, okay. So, yeah, and the one thing that I really like about Petroglyph Press is that people who ordinarily otherwise would not have a voice have an opportunity to bring their vision and their voice out there so that people can consume it
covered
and check it out.
Artwork, it's, mm-hmm. It's all done by the artists.
Well, and one of the ideas, too, is that we are including a lot of people in the community in these efforts. We have artists coming in doing the artwork. We've got it's just creating a lot of collaboration among mm-hmm. artists and poets in mm-hmm. At least in the Inland Empire area.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another big thing, is to get this, to bring people out of the woodwork so they can not only just be writing in isolation or publishing in faraway books, but to actually be part of the community that we're trying to help create in the Inland Empire and desert regions.
Okay, great.
A little dismal,
it's,
but we're getting there.
Yeah,
it's a whole different model than mm-hmm. other where, you know, you take a bath on printing 5,000 of one poet, you could print mm-hmm. you know, 100 books from, 20 poets and, mm-hmm. you know, give a lot more people a voice. Mm-hmm. And so that's one of the main reasons why, it's possible now because of short run press and mm-hmm. laser printing and
cool.
It's beautiful.
We also envision mm-hmm. a press where people, not just that people are being ignored because mm-hmm. maybe they don't go in the right to the right MFA program,
mm-hmm.
But also that a lot of the stuff we're publishing is could be controversial, or mm-hmm. very easily censored, or just scorned at because mm-hmm. of subject matter, and so we're really trying to project poetry and put writing out there that might be difficult to sell
mm-hmm.
in terms of like we get back to the idea of who's running the show, who's the authority figure.
Mm-hmm.
How come things with this cuss word can't be in a poem? So
yeah.
we want an honest, authentic experience mm-hmm. for our readers to have coming
oh,
from
good.
People writing authentically and honestly.
Well, I hope I have a chance because I will put shit in a poem.
Oh.
Yes.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
If controversial. So. and I'd like to add, too, that we're not trying to say we're condoning a certain point of view, or that we're saying, you know, what somebody, like, because when I was helping to edit and revise Dana Ryan's books, you know, I was kind of like, oh my God, you know, I don't necessarily personally, you know, want to sit and read a lot of some of the stuff they're writing about, but I want to promote, you know, a lot of freedom and expression, and for people to tell, to speak honestly and creatively as they need to or feel. So the press is an idea that, you know, would help promote that.
Okay. As a matter of fact, I believe you have some work that you'd like to share with us as well, Jeff?
Yeah, I could. Well, why don't we have one of them read a poem?
Okay, great. Well, let's start with Ryan, because Ryan is one of the artists who's been published. Was it the first chapbook that was published by Petroglyph?
Yes.
It was?
Yes.
Okay. Ryan is Ryan Peters. Okay, good, good.
Okay.
I got my I have my surname straight now.
We are in law, so I have to read this. It's called The Boob in the Hand.
Okay.
Start off with a little quote. "You may know what you need, but to get what you want, better see that you keep what you have." Stephen Sondheim. "I've held many breasts in my time. I generally use the handful as a measure. I've always been kind of a one and a half to two handful kind of fella. On one occasion, I got to fondle some beautiful boobs. I was dancing the freak at the club when I squeezed my first fake breasts. On a visual inspection, they were perfect, but no amount of appreciation could change the feeling of unyielding plastic masses where there should be soft, watery, warm wonders of nature. Upon reflection, I know I must add natural to my list of desired breast qualities. Still, I'll take them however they come and reject no tits." All right, and there we go.
Oops, hang on just a second here. Read into this one, isn't it?
All right.
Actually, they're going to have you read into this one, which will be a much more successful picture.
All right.
There we go.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. This one's a little bit more raw. It's kind of over the edge, and it's good we're on the internet.
That's more raw than a boob in the hand?
It's more. They get a lot worse. That one's only slightly dirty.
I'm ready for this one.
This one's called Erato, and I consider it a prayer. Most people consider it to be so disrespectful, but that it cannot be a prayer. "Although I suck your clit devoutly, you will never lick my shaven balls. Oral never did pop me off anyway. But I don't want to fuck you in any of your three holes. I want you to show me how to fuck perfect strangers at a distance. In honor of this gift, I will service your ample boobs and wet folds. I will die in gooey bliss and make heaven sticky like orgy-stained sheets." Here we go. And then I think I'll pass it over to my friend Dana, who has a lovely poem.
Very original.
That's a religious.
I've never heard any guy talk like that before.
Yeah, Dana's a very religious person. He believes that we should all have sex with Jesus.
No. Well, yeah. Well,
one thing I'd like to say after you've heard Ryan's poetry is a lot of people.
That's hard to follow there, Dana.
Criticize Ryan's work and my work as being too vulgar and maybe not a source of goodness. But I had a kid come up to me at a poetry reading once who said, "You know, I really like your poems, but I didn't think I was allowed to say those kind of things." And I said, "Allowed, man, you're free. You can do anything you want."
Yeah.
And what the poetry that Ryan just read to you is somebody that's breaking the rules, standards of norms, and he's saying you can be free, and that's a source of goodness, I think, in the world. Bukowski basically implied the same thing about his writing.
Oh, gosh, yes. Bukowski was very, you know, was very strong. Burroughs as well.
My writing's not near as vulgar as Ryan's, but I'll see what I can do for you. It's just called Sexy Jesus, and I have a quote that starts it off. It says, "It's stupid to hate gay people." And that's by the comedian Ron White. "Jesus, you are so homoerotic, with your long feminine hair and your slender androgynous model's body, such a boyish Kate Moss. I'm not otherwise discipled, but I'd bump dickheads with you anytime. Watch you strip for me, my Eucharist queer savior, out of your toga jammies, and show me why John Holmes is just another John the Baptist. What else could my response be to the God incarnate's singularly beautiful pee-pee? That divine trouser cross, as you monkey to live amongst us, so ballsy. I'd even fag fuck you in the fanny, like San Francisco were heaven, and we'd have our own golden gay. But know that my anal prayer would be an act of love, agape, because I know you didn't have toilet paper back then. It'd be a dirty job. I mean, holy shit, for lubrication, my sexy lord. Now, I'm a Christian. Most people think, how can you say such blasphemous things? But I don't think God's an asshole. Well, I think he can laugh. I think that I'm perfectly within the bounds, and I bet you Jesus is going, yeah, yeah. People who think, oh, that guy's going to hell for sure, I say, don't underestimate the grace of Christ.
You can buy this chapbook at St. Margaret's Church in Riverside. it's with the prayer books.
And I suppose I'll do one more.
It's right behind pew 3.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what kind of audience this is, but I'll do one that's more literary.
It's a Kill Radio audience, so I think they'll like stuff like sexy Jesus just as much as the so-called literary stuff.
This one's called Having Sex with Emily Dickinson.
Ooh, that minx.
That love is all there is all we know of love. It is enough. The freight should be proportioned to the groove. Emily. Her sexy darkness would be all graveyard chic, all deathy necrophilic fantasies. She'd close her perceptive goth eyes, go limp and sometimes stiff, depending on the convenience of my positional comfort. Our momentary theory of how an actual corpse would present its malleability. Ooh, smart chicks. All subtle rubby-dub-dub. And especially Emily. All quiet there, contemplating God knows what great poem. But I don't concern myself with that. Wow, she's mine. What could be greater than that? But when I'm done with her, yes, and when she's done with me, she has that notepad there. Cigarettes even have to wait. Then she writes with her dicky slant, and I feminist it out of there, out of her way, like a capital M man not a man should, as she dashes out of her mind.
Okay, you've got to have something about Dorothy Parker in there too, right? No, nothing, nothing about taking an ice bath and lying still or Sylvia Plath, anything like that. No.
I really want to share this short poem because it's the nastiest thing that I've written, and it's probably the nastiest thing that I could come up with.
Okay.
Although it was suggested that I could include a miscarriage to make it worse. Called Krusty Taco, and after this, you will never think of tacos the same again.
Okay.
Starts off with a little quotation from the Holy Bible. If a woman has a discharge, and the discharge from her body is blood, she shall be set apart 7 days. If any man lies at all so that her impurity is on him, he shall be unclean 7 days, and every bed on which he lies will be unclean. Leviticus chapter 15, verses 19 and 24. Would you eat that crusty taco? Pussy snack, almost a nacho. She'd bled black blood in slurping flow. She's pissed and let the crystals crack. Shall you chew this moist fat crack hoe? Should you see it, would your lips smack? Would you eat that crusty taco? Pussy snack, almost a nacho.
You were asking me to read some poems about other people like Sylvia Plath and such. Well, that doesn't mention Sylvia, but it mentions a few other women. It's called Women of History.
Okay.
Women's styles may change, but their designs remain the same. Oscar Wilde. I like beauty so much that I would dig up Helen of Troy's corpse and fuck her skeleton. Then I could say, I did her too, Odysseus. And Cleopatra and her ass. Mark my words, I'd fall for her like Eve in the garden, adamantly. And the great nuclear physicist Marie Curie? Talk about a big bang. And the Virgin of Guadalupe? Not when I'm done with her. And speaking of church girls, let's not forget Madonna. She's burning up for my love. And the ancient Greek philosopher Hypatia? The conversations we'd have, such Neoplatonic dirty talk. And Gloria Steinem? Ms. Magazine gets me off. I like strong women, the sheer pornography of it.
And yeehaw, I dig wholesome girls too, like country singer Martina McBride. I'd like to ring her Southern Belle. And Helen Keller? Talk about a perfect woman. I always tell people that I like to get me one of those silent Helen Keller bitches. And Susan B. Anthony? Let's deface the coinage. And Edna St. Vincent Millay? I'd burn her candle at both ends, one at a time. George O'Keefe? I'd pollinate her pussy willows. And Sarah McLachlan? She can sing Adia to me anytime. I mean it, anytime. Call me. And Frida Kahlo? Ooh, I have an eyebrow fetish just thinking about it. And Leonardo's Mona Lisa? Another corpse that must be dug up. An Academy Award winner, Julia Roberts? She certainly looks like she's got a good dick-sucking mouth. Marilyn Monroe? I'd put my candle in her wind, true blonde or not. And Samson's Delilah? You can shave my pubic hair. Depth psychologist Karen Horney? Her name says it all. Oh, let's not forget Emily Dickinson. Dickinson. I'd let her be passive as death, guiltless, still a virgin, wink, wink. And Abelard's Heloise? I'd right her wrongs and show her what it's like to love a man with balls. And the lesbo Sappho? All she needs is a proper-sized penis, mine, and an introduction to a modern vibrating dildo. She'll be waiting in the rain for the morning cock to grunt. Emily Bronte? Stalker, it's over. Stay away. I'll get a restraining order. And stop calling me Heathcliff. And I'd love to watch Anne Rand masturbate. The virtue of selfishness at last. And Joan Jett and Gwen Stefani? Maybe I could make one tit between them. I'd use a French word to describe it, but I'd hate to be vulgar. But then again, there's Marie Antoinette. I'd let her eat my cake and teach the spoiled rich bitch to bake my bread.
We'll be leaving the studio now. So.
Dana Stamps will be appearing on ABC's The Bachelor this week.
The women are lining up,
and a Christian.
Oh, my. So, okay. So, you've hit practically every woman there, and you've left Anna Eastman alone. Thank you.
She's a dirty girl. I don't go for those.
Oh, you don't dig dirty girls. Oh, okay. And
too risque for me. I like the conservative types.
We got Dana Stamps here, as well as Ryan Peters. Ryan Peters, who also has a book entitled Screaming Wet Mammals. And he was like in a fist fight defending some chalk art on his cover. So where can you guys... Where are you?
We're on MySpace, actually.
Oh, yeah.
We've had some trouble reading. A lot of places have censored us.
Really?
Get
out of
here. It really strikes me as unfortunate because censorship, I think, should be something that's inviolate. And it's a very important thing. And people are censoring us because of vulgarity. And, I mean, censorship should be a pure thing. I mean, we're going to turn totalitarian if we're not careful.
It's also worth mentioning that our press is publishing a book written by a Hindu Swami. So we're very diverse in what we're doing. And that's the idea, that we're not feeling pigeonholed into a certain theme or agenda. We're not agenda-driven. We are, you know, content-driven.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. Great. That's awesome. Now, Jeff, you got a couple more or one or two more?
Read a couple poems.
Sure. Yeah, please do. Okay. We'd love to hear you. And Ruth, you also have a couple more, right?
I do.
Okay. And also, if you're out there and you'd like to share your you'd like to share your depraved poetry about chaste women in history, please give us a call at 213-252-0998. We've got a couple of poems here. Dana cracks me up, I swear.
I found it, Jeff.
Oh, okay. Is this the one about Anna Eastman?
No.
Oh, okay.
This is about George Bush. It's a favorable poem about his hopeful third term.
Okay. Ooh, okay. So we're going to get to that in just a second. But we've got some more from Jeff. And before we close out, we'll have a couple more by Ruth as well. Okay, so what do you have there,
this
Jeff?
This is called Some of the Lines in This Poem Are Stolen. I fucking ripped them off. And you won't even know which ones are mine and which ones I took. And when I steal, I get to call it sampling, because I'm a postmodern poet. Still, I juiced them from some forgettable dead wordy Wordsworth, just like a wise mortician slipping the ring off of a dead bride. What's she gonna do, haunt me? I'm not gonna credit the pre-modern bastard either, because that asshole just left his poems laying there with no one watching them. Besides, they had lots of poems, and I don't, and I need some poems. I need 2 poems a week minimum to maintain my current standard of living. Just the other day, I was at an open mic, and I only had 1 new poem, and since it was the same people, and they all heard the old ones, I felt, I don't know, I guess, uncool. And that's one thing a postmodern poet can't afford. Nowadays, it's impossible to pass off uncool lines, and it's cool to plagiarize, because no one gives a shit about history, or who wrote what. No one that matters is going to read this or argue that I am or am not a thief. History is like geography, where entire cities are dots. No one gives a shit what the names of the bomber pilots were, or the pinned mothers and children under slabs of concrete rubble too big for would-be rescuers who hear the knocking and the scratching for hours before they can get to sleep. Those are all just problems for positivists, adding up to little more than general explanations of forces, trends, and who has the power to take what they want.
All right. Yeah. Very nice. I like that one. That's cool. Okay. And let me see. We've got 1 more from Dana.
I feel a little guilty for reading that Women in History one. I have
No. Don't feel guilty. No.
Feminist poem. If I could read 2 short ones and then be done with mine, would that be cool?
No, that's fine. That's fine. No, don't. And no, there's no guilt here.
I would do both. This is called Pop God. Wives, be subject to your husbands as to the Lord. Paul of Tarsus, Ephesians 6:22. Maybe Jesus was female, but flat-chested, and because she was so outspoken and articulate, most people just assumed that she was male. Does it seem right that God be masculine and not feminist? Would it be shameful to call God her, our mother who art in heaven, female be her name? Do you think God has a penis? Does he become aroused, or does he just stay flaccid, our omnipotent God? He. Could Son of God meant light of God, the sun-like light, not the son, the boy of God? You know, these and countless others are lots of questions for something so many folks are so certain about. He. She is always a head in the household. He, husband, is never the only head. Well, only the dickhead, if he thinks this god-awful biblical chauvinism is right and comes from God, the womb of all being. Does God masturbate? Of course she does. She uses the Hubble Space Telescope as a vibrator for her divine clitoris in the sky, like a gigantic steamy star going supernova. Jesus saves. Yes, he or she does. Maybe the long hair was a clue, and the beard was the fault of Marcel Duchamp in a past life. And after all, God is holy, not pokey. Praise her.
I always thought that was a comet in the sky. Little did I know. I'm sorry.
I want you to laugh. That's good. I'm trying to engender laughter. It works.
You have another one.
This is Jeff, the one Jeff requested.
Okay.
And this one's called Fucking Republicans. What's in a name? Billy Shakespeare. The most famous person who ever personally insulted me was George Herbert Walker Bush. That is, George Bush Sr., the 41st president of the United States of America. I was watching Comedy Central. I don't know what show was on, but I was having a good time, smoking pot, drinking whiskey, and my girlfriend sucking my dick. And a commercial came on, and surprise, surprise, there was George Bush Sr., and he started talking about Dana Carvey, the comedian, about how much he, Bush, enjoyed the impressions that Carvey humorously made of him on Saturday Night Live. And then it came, like a jolt, I being coincidentally a man named Dana also, like a bolt straight from the hand of Zeus. Former President Bush said, after being so very nice, that what he couldn't understand was, what kind of a man is named Dana, anyway? There he was, on television, in my living room, challenging my manhood. It stunned me so much that I almost lost my erection. Burnt my roach with a decent roach of chronic and spilt my Jack and Coke. My girlfriend never even noticed all this. She was way too busy enjoying herself with my trouser obelisk. And I decided not to tell her about how Bush maligned me, because she was, I'm not unsorry to say, a Republican. With a good Bush, not a bad pubic hair to vote on.
That was Dana Stamps, and I don't think we went over the title of your chapbook, did we?
Sexy Jesus.
That's right,
poems.
Sexy Jesus. Sexy Jesus, as well as Ryan Peters' Screaming Wet Mammals, are two of the first releases from Petroglyph Press. Correct?
Yeah, and we're based in the Inland Empire, Riverside, and the desert region, Palm Springs, and so forth.
So, yeah. So
featuring writers from that area.
Oh, okay. So you guys are from the Inland Empire. So, yeah. So if anyone tells you that the Inland Empire doesn't know how to party, then we've got a couple for you. So, Ruth, you've got a couple more that you're going to...
I do.
Because we've got about 5 minutes to go before the next show
actually,
comes up.
Actually, I was just really... I've always liked Bukowski. Who doesn't?
Oh, sweet.
And this was a challenge someone gave me. Mm-hmm. When I found out that the Bukowski manuscript, and forgive me if I'm wrong, anybody who's listening, is in the Huntington Library, a lot of his poetry and letters, original manuscripts, the idea would be, would I go in there and masturbate to those while I'm reading them, because they're so amazing. This is called Compassion for the Terrorist. I would not find myself masturbating to Bukowski's poetry and original manuscripts, all 111 or 999 of them in the Huntington Library, just to say I did it. I wouldn't cry at Ground Zero, New York City, if I couldn't imagine that the men who flew those planes loved death more than life. Who can argue with that? Tall hat chefs, undoubtedly fewer men than women, leaping from the 44th, 66th, 102nd floors. You share the same birthday with those who perished that day, but you avoided death by flame. Life, as Chuck himself might say, is filled with unexpected pain. Arriving in suitcases, the brand of moon stamped on mountain flanks. Weeping is the icing for the survivors who make birthday cakes for children, who will erupt towards the top of the new memorial towers, not knowing the full story, not remembering. The men will march upward again. Another warm beer, another forward thrust fuck. Now men in America know what it's like to get raped. The bakers will continue to bake. The crying will continue to emote. The candles will be lit and blown out. The smear mark on nearby surviving buildings at Ground Zero will testify that no one wants to pretend to have a handful of the real thing. When the chocolate smears and the hand-typed poems of Bukowski himself, furtively sneaking the poems to editors across the nation in his mailbag and sneering at the man of some distant embryonic and despised land, always easy to target the conglomerate of bureaucracy. It's not our fault the plane slipped past the Statue of Liberty. I still believe in figureheads. I still believe that surviving in Victorian-era sailboats, the biggest and boldest of their time, that stole the salmon and timber and the Native Americans' wheat to build empires, Valclutha, goddess of the sea, is actually a guiding white light when waves smash across the deck, when gilded planes crash across glass windows and melt steel. When it all comes down, the Greek dress-clad woman out front is guiding us all, and Bukowski would probably want to fuck her, but she's embedded in the wood. He'd have to climb way out front on the lowered mast, take his chances with the sharks, and crawl up from bottom, bury himself in her ivory robes, this one lying down, breast pointed towards the sea, almost, perhaps not as tired as the woman holding the torch with her arms raised high. But almost, there must be at least 9 of them worldwide, and 1 + 1 equals more than 2. And how the men hold on to us before they let go, let go, let go, and you shall have your cake too. Happy birthday to you.
Oh, nice. Very nice. So that's going to bring us up to the end here. So we do have a few more seconds. So you said that you had a MySpace page for Petroglyph Press?
We do.
Okay.
And so people can check that for now, or they can email Jeff at jeffe@epicentermagazine.org. They can email me, runaolan@aol.com.
Yeah.
For more information. We're really trying to get our press off the ground and just get that cool chapbook vibe going with a diversity of different types of poets and writers.
Oh, sweet. Okay. And what's your MySpace page?
It's just under Petroglyph Press. Okay. I don't have the exact URL. Maybe Dana has it over there.
Okay. Could it be myspace.com/petroglyph or?
Yeah.
Dana.
If you do the, just do the search for Petroglyph Press, you'll find.
Okay. So yeah, if you do a search for Petroglyph Press on, say, Google.
Good luck.
Okay. Yeah.
We're 4 months old, man.
Okay.
We will have a web page soon.
Or
Petroglyph Press. So come back, at the end of the summer.
Yeah, so Petroglyph is spelled.
Books, not web pages.
We're too busy.
So Petroglyph is spelled PETROGLYPH, and make a search on it. You'll find Petroglyph Press, and you'll find the works of Ruth Nolan and Ryan Peters and Dana Stamps, who has this beautiful picture of the Hubble telescope vibrating. So.
But it's broken.
It's broken.
After Dana got through with it,
It's got a little twisty on the end that switches it on and off. Yeah. So I want to thank you so much for being here. Yeah, it was really great to have
fun.
You here. Yeah.
Thank you.
And Jeff, also, it's great having you here.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, both of you representing Petroglyph Press, and it's great to hear your poetry. And same goes for you guys. Ryan, Dana, it was great to have you guys here. And I hope hope you have the chance to come by again. That would be great. Okay. And this is James Maverick. You guys are listening to Higher Ground, Coast to Coast. And for more information, all you have to do is just click on the link on the shows on the Kill Radio schedule page for Higher Ground, Coast to Coast, and you can send an email. And if you also wish to become part of the festivities and part of the fun, then please feel free to submit some of your work as well. Because, again, this is from coast to coast. We interviewed someone from Florida a couple of weeks ago, Larry Jaffe, a good friend of mine.
Yeah, I'm friends with Larry also.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah.
Everybody knows Larry in L.A.
Yeah, everyone knows Larry. And he's in Florida.
Yeah.
So, so anywhere in America, we will be happy to have you here as a guest, whether in studio as Ruth and company or virtually over the phone here. So, thanks for being here. This is James Maverick. You're listening to www.killradio.org.